From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard Magazine. Joining me on the show this week are Oren Dorel, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today, and after a lengthy hiatus, Laura Meckler, staff writer with the Wall Street Journal. Welcome back to the program, Laura.
Thank you.
And here are the issues. President Trump announced the United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. The withdrawal process takes 3 years. Trump's action intensified his growing feud with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. In Afghanistan, a truck bombing killed 80 people in Kabul's diplomatic zone, wounded 460, and devastated entire blocks of the capital city. And in Washington, former Vice President Joe Biden is planning to start a new political action committee, an indication he will stay active in politics and is considering running for president in 2020. I may be exaggerating on whether he's actually considering that or not, but I need to build the story up a little bit. I happen to be personally interested in it. Anyway, Laura, let's start with what Trump did in the Paris Treaty. What's your take?
Well, I think that on a symbolic level, it's extraordinarily significant. He's essentially thumbing his nose at the rest of the world. We're joining Syria and Nicaragua as the only three countries that will not be participating in this, and Nicaragua declined because they didn't think it went far enough. You know, it certainly gives a win to the people, the forces in his administration and his supporters who want this so-called America First agenda, which, of course, rejects any sense of globalism or sense of cooperation with other nations giving in order to get. On the other hand, though, I don't know if the practical effects are all that significant. This was a voluntary agreement. We weren't committed to anything. He already had undone signaled he's going to undo two of the most significant Obama-era environmental regulations. So he, you know, with or without the Paris Agreement, he had already kind of rolled back the efforts to try to control carbon emissions in this country. And the last point I would make is that there is a lot happening in the private sector already and also on the state level moving us in this direction. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if the actual impact, and that will continue.
Oren?
So President Trump packaged this as an assertion, quote, an assertion of sovereignty for the United States. And people are looking at it, you know, is it an abdication of American leadership on the world stage? The reaction to this, whether the practical impacts are going to be severe or not, the reaction has been pretty negative around the world. France, Germany, and Italy expressed regret. They promised to increase their own efforts to implement the agreement. China said that it will step up and be a global leader on climate change, which is
even though it's increasing over the coming years, its
right.
use of coal.
Russia said that they're sticking with the agreement, which gives them kind of a little bit of a kudos. Also, the reaction has been pretty negative, almost across the board. Some American business leaders have been condemning this move. Jeff Immelt, the CEO of General Electric, said he was disappointed. You know, the question, one of the elements of this is that it looks to a lot of people, if you combine this with President Trump's comments last week at the NATO summit and his criticism of NATO, it looks like kind of a retreat from American leadership on the world stage, and people are wondering what's going to replace it.
The Laura, this was not a treaty that was ratified in a way which would have made it almost impossible, I think, for Donald Trump to reverse it. President Obama just agreed to it and signed the U.S. on, and he didn't send it to Congress to ratify it. Why not?
Well, he didn't send it to the Senate because he didn't think that the Senate would ratify it. I mean, in a nutshell, you need a two-thirds majority to ratify treaties. Obviously, the filibuster, anybody could have filibustered it as well. Mm-hmm. Republicans controlled the Senate at that time, as they do today. So,
is that the way things are supposed to work? If you just think
it's not going to. Well, I mean, there were consequences to that, though. I mean, mm-hmm. because it wasn't ratified, I mean, obviously it can be undone. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, the agreement itself is, as we've said, voluntary. Yep. And that's why, and if you're going to do a treaty that obligates us or mm-hmm. an agreement that obligates us to mm-hmm. something, then I think that maybe a treaty mm-hmm. might have been mandated. So, I mean, it was looser because of the way it came into mm-hmm. it. And obviously it's easier to get out of. I mean, the interesting thing is that it's true that like countries around the world have condemned this decision, but the reaction from Republicans in Congress has been positive. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've praised President Trump for getting out of mm-hmm. this. So there is a great divide on this issue.
Are there real, Oren, are there real economic disadvantages that Trump has killed now for the U.S. by getting out of the treaty? And, I mean, were there economic disadvantages for the U.S.? That's certainly what Trump said. I've heard many other people say that. I've read that in the Wall Street Journal editorial page, Laura, which you're, of course, not responsible for.
I have to admit that I have not been covering this issue in its details. But what I understand is that some of the things that some of the disadvantages that he described have been described as not so great for certain parties. There are requirements, for instance, to capture methane, which is a greenhouse gas mm-hmm. by oil drillers. Big oil companies already capture the methane. They mm-hmm. they have pipelines and they put the methane into the pipeline and use it for fuel, create fuel out of it. Smaller producers, it's a cost for them to do that. Whether it's actually not all that clear to me whether all the jobs that he described that would be lost and all the trillions of dollars mm-hmm. that this would cost, whether or not that would somehow be replaced by other new technologies and new innovative technologies that would be the energy of the future. And that was the Obama administration argument mm-hmm. was that, and he came out with a statement that this was basically cutting off a new technology, high technology industry in the making.
Okay, I'm going to stop there unless anybody has something more to say about it. But I have been fascinated by feud, maybe too strong a word, maybe not, between German Chancellor Merkel and Donald Trump. I remember when Merkel was here in the United States about a month ago, maybe it's longer ago than that. It was when you saw them, when they had a joint press conference, it was one of the most awkward ones I think I've ever seen, Laura. What about this whole thing?
Yeah, it was chilly for sure. Yeah. when she was here. I think that, I mean, they represent such totally different points of view, and there's just a you can just see it when you see them next to each other. And I think that this pulling out of the Paris Accord is certainly of a piece of that, where mm-hmm. she is a leader in terms of, wanting a sense of internationalism. That I think the interesting thing that happened just this last week was following President Trump's visit to Europe and mm-hmm. meeting with the G7, where he indicated, and with NATO, and where he indicated that essentially he was not committed to the Paris Agreement and set the stage for this withdrawal. You know, she gave a speech last weekend, I think it was, where she basically
in a beer
said,
hall.
Yeah, it was a campaign type speech. And she yep. basically said, you know what? We're not depending on the U.S. or anyone else, or Britain mm-hmm. for that matter, which pulled out mm-hmm. of the EU, for our future. We will be our future. And yeah. and there's a real alliance between her and the new president of France, Macron, mm-hmm. to work together in terms of Europe and its mm-hmm. unity and its leadership in the world. So I do think that it's not real surprising when you look at her and her agenda and you mm-hmm. look at President Trump that the two of them are not going to, he's not going to be giving her any back rubs like George W. Bush famously did.
Yeah, I remember that, Oren.
So, first of all, she is campaigning. Angela Merkel is campaigning for to become chancellor, to be named chancellor, to be reelected in September, I believe. And President Trump happens to be rather unpopular in Germany. So the kinds of things that she's saying and her stance toward him fit within the campaign dynamic for her. It helps her, actually. But she and President Trump are at odds on the issue of NATO, on the issue of Russia's meddling in elections and you know confronting NATO on its eastern flank in Ukraine, its actions in Ukraine. They're far apart, obviously, on climate change and on trade. So these are all really big issues that they disagree on. But that said, the two sides still have to work together. You know, she made a lot of interesting comments in the last week, and one of them is that you know that Germany is going to have to step up, that the Europeans are going to have to rely more on each other, and not rely so much on the United States for their own defense. That actually fits into what President Trump has been saying, which is that the Germans and the Europeans need to up their game when it comes to their defense contributions. Mm-hmm. So some of these things are, you know, there's an element of this. It's hard to tell how much the United States and Europe are really going to pull apart. But there's an element of this tough love thing that Trump is trying to, you know, that whether he's actually means to be unfriendly to the Europeans or whether this is an element of tough love of trying to get them to do more.
Yeah, I don't know about the love, but it's certainly tough. No question about that.
There was a quote that I came across by Anna Sobery, who's the editor of Der Tagesspiegel, the opinion page. And she said, you know, the question is how long can the United States and Europe work together without being friends? Because she was saying basically that there are a lot of things where we cooperate anyhow, but how long can this relationship last without it being a little bit better?
You know, Laura, Merkel sounds like she thinks she's speaking for all of Europe when she talks. You know, she talks about we, not about Germany. Does she speak for Europe?
Well, I mean, does anybody speak for millions of people? But I do think that, and as a general rule, you know, Donald Trump is not popular in Europe. And,
that's for sure.
You know, but there is a nationalist anti-immigration sentiment that is pulsing through Europe that's very strong. And that, you know, where there is a sense of camaraderie, perhaps, with Trump and his worldview. So I don't think she speaks for all of Europe. You know, you look at Marie Le Pen in France, who got, you know, did not win. And, you know, she was beat handily. That said, she got, a third of the vote, more than a third of the vote of France. So, I mean, that's not nothing. So I do think that there is an element in Europe that probably does not see it her way. But I'm not an expert on this, but my guess is that she does speak for a lot of Europeans when she talks about wanting a sense of unity.
If I can add to that.
Sure.
That's an interesting question because Europe's been through a bunch of traumas lately. They had the Brexit, the British exit from the European Union, this Ukraine-Russia war that really surprised them. Nobody expected to see a tank war happening in Europe at this time. The migrant crisis, but all of these actually caused the Europeans to consolidate and to become to unify a little bit more rather than to split apart. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what she's capitalizing on.
You know, one thing I was surprised at was that after Trump, as a part of his feud here, attacked Germany, saying their trade policies were terrible because they didn't they exported far more to the United States and other countries than they imported. And he was out there saying this. He was condemned in the U.S. And then some of the leaders in Europe got behind him and said the same thing. On trade, Germany is terrible toward us.
Right. Well, I mean, I was surprised
to hear this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are complicated issues. This isn't just a simple thing. I mean, and I think a lot of people try to oversimplify it. But in fact, there's, you know.
That's what we're here for.
Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead quickly.
Well, if the trade thing, the European Union is supposed to be an economic union and it's supposed to be acting sort of as a unit. Germany may, you know, not to jump to their defense, but they also help a lot of European countries, and they underwrite a lot of debt for European countries who may have been some of the ones that were complaining.
All right. We're going to have more in just a minute. And first, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show today are Laura Meckler of the Wall Street Journal and Oren Durrell of USA Today. And this is a reminder that you can listen online to Issues as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click the iTunes tab, if you can find it, on the website at voanews.com. Well, what about Afghanistan, Laura? You know, here we had this horrible bombing, but I'm particularly interested in U.S. policy, which seems to be up in the air at the moment. General John Nicholson, who's the top American commander in Afghanistan, wants more troops. I don't think he specified the number, but I think there are 10,000 American troops there, and he wants more. Where particularly is the U.S. going? I don't know that this would encourage the U.S. to send more troops, actually.
Right. Well,
I mean,
that's
this is ultimately
true.
Trump's
decision. Well, it kind of cuts both ways, I think. Mm-hmm. I think that what's on the table is the proposal to send somewhere in the 3,000 to 5,000 range of additional troops.
Okay.
President Trump has not made a decision on this. It's a tough decision for him in particular, and it actually in some ways echoes a decision that President Obama had to make early in his administration. Mm-hmm. He was also faced with Afghanistan is a mess. It's bad and doesn't seem to be getting better. Should we double down and put more troops there? And we did. And, here we are today. I mean, I don't know that we can say whether things would have been better or worse without that additional investment. But clearly the country is still in chaos. The government there who we back controls just about a quarter of the country. This horrible terrorist act that happened this week it obviously gives anybody pause. Donald Trump campaigned on a promise of disentanglement, of the idea of America first means you don't, send Americans to die in Afghanistan if we don't have core interests at heart. Mm-hmm. So that was definitely part of him. On the other hand, he has a lot of respect and pays a lot of deference to generals. He throughout his administration, during the transition, you saw him repeatedly turning to them. He stocked his cabinet with generals. And what are they telling him? They're telling him, well, they're saying what generals generally say, which is that we need more troops. And so now he has a tough decision to make.
Mm. Oren?
This war has been going on for 15 years, and we're saddled with, as tends to happen, with a government that is an Afghan government that is weak and corrupt, and an Afghan military that, despite billions of dollars spent and thousands of people who've gone there to train them, who still can't stand up in battle to really defend themselves in a very consistent way. They've been losing territory to the Taliban. They've had a series of disasters this year so far, with a whole district lost and cities that have been taken and taken back and then lost again and then being on the verge and then taken back again and then still on the verge of being seized again by the Taliban. This bombing happened in basically in the diplomatic sector.
Yeah, I read that it was the most guarded and protected sector in all of Kabul.
Yeah,
yet this basically garbage truck got through.
It damaged something like four or five different diplomatic missions. Diplomats from the UAE, from Germany, and I forget what other country are evacuating the country after this bombing. And this incident looks to me like it was aimed at this peace conference that was supposed to start next week. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to figure out how they can get all these facilities cleaned up and get the glass cleaned up and put the windows back in before they have conferences in the same buildings that were damaged, I think starting Tuesday or Wednesday or something like that. So And it was supposed to be a big international conference where everybody was going to come together, and the Ashraf Ghani, the Afghan president, was going to take control of the peace process and try to talk to the Taliban and get them to negotiate or figure out some kind of way forward. This doesn't look good for that process, and it actually looks like whoever launched this attack was trying to disrupt the peace process altogether. And that is another issue with this war, is that the Afghans believe that the Pakistani inter-services ISI is really behind a lot of this, these attacks that they're dealing with, and behind to supporting at least branches of the Taliban. And that's in territory that they don't control. So it's a complicated situation, and what the American policy is still very unclear.
All right, Joe Biden, the vice president to President Obama for decades before that, a senator from Delaware, was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I think at one point Senate chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I was at a basketball game about a month ago, and in the Verizon Center in downtown Washington, in a professional basketball game, and Joe Biden came in. And I'll look, Washington's a liberal city, and the crowd may be mostly Democrats, but I was still surprised at the thunderous applause that Joe Biden got. People standing all over, and it was a packed house, standing, and it was very long applause. I think maybe he's more popular than I thought anyway. So what about Joe Biden's future, and is this forming a political action committee, am I reading too much of it into it by thinking, well, gee, he may run for president in 2020. He is 74 already.
Right. Well, if you are, others are as well. He has wanted to be president maybe his entire life, maybe his entire adult life. He's been on the public stage for many, many years. Decades. He is somebody who badly wants that, and who I think on some level also craves this kind of attention. Mm-hmm. He is very popular. He's beloved, I think, in a way that not all politicians are beloved. That said, he thought seriously about running last mm-hmm. year. He decided not to. The timetable wasn't great with the death of his son, Beau, but he had a window even given that, and he didn't take it. He didn't take that step. I think mm-hmm. he regrets that, certainly because Hillary lost. He regrets it even more. And mm-hmm. he doesn't want to let go, totally let go of the dream. And I think he wants people like us talking about it right mm-hmm. now, and he likes walking into the Verizon Center and having people thunderously applaud. And who wouldn't? Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, whether he would actually be a good candidate or not at the end of the day is a separate issue. But I do think I personally think the chances of him actually running are quite small, mm-hmm. much to the dismay perhaps of the political press corps.
Right.
But I think he still wants to be relevant, and this is a way to do it.
Yeah, I think if he had run in 2016 and were the Democratic nominee, I think he would have done better than Hillary Clinton, had a better chance of winning. But we'll never know. Oren?
Well, he's got this 8-year experience of being a senior advisor to President Obama, mm-hmm. having kind of playing this role, mm-hmm. and of he has this reputation, and he is really a guy who speaks from the heart. He's mm-hmm. prone to a lot of gaffes,
yeah,
but that is sort of the thing these days. So mm-hmm. maybe he figures he's got a good chance.
That's the thing these days, gaffes.
Well,
from the heart.
You know, we're well ahead of 2020 when Donald Trump or somebody will be the Republican nominee for president. And Joe Biden, probably age is a factor that doesn't work to his benefit.
No.
This sort of creeps up all the time, how old you can be and still be elected president.
I do think that the Democratic Party has a challenge when the focus is on so many people who are quite old. I mean, we're talking about mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders, even Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden. These are not mm-hmm. new faces.
Yeah.
And the party needs some new faces, mm-hmm. some new energy to come along. And I think that's one of the things that they're struggling with now. They need to figure out.
Oren?
I'm not sure I have much to add to that.
Yeah, I have a lot to add, but I'm not going to. I like Joe Biden. He's one of the most genial people you can meet in Washington.
Nicest guy.
There are a lot of people in Washington, as you all would know, that you would rather turn around and go the other direction when you see them. But Joe Biden isn't one of those, one of the friendliest guys. And I still remember at a luncheon when Jesse Helms, the most conservative Republican in the Senate, was retiring and who came and spoke very long and with a long and endearing speech about him? Joe Biden.
Well, that's in that that kind of shows he's almost like a throwback to a time, a different kind of time when you did the parties did talk to each other, when people did work together. He was one of President Obama's main conduits to the Congress, when to the Senate in particular, when he was when they were in office. So yes, he's old school and the best of the bunch.
All right. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Laura Meckler, staff writer with The Wall Street Journal, and Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.